You'll remember that the book of Revelation is a book of visions and messages given to John. John himself is kind of suffering persecution in that he's exiled. The churches are definitely suffering some persecution and will suffer a lot more, but also pressure to compromise. And to John and to those churches and to us, this spectacular set of visions is given. The vision of Jesus that begins Revelation, and then these visions following through, and then the messages to the churches which connect both with the vision of Jesus at the start of the book and with what comes in the rest of the book. Remember, it's a picture book. It's not really full of puzzles that are completely obscure. It's a book of pictures. It's full of symbols and images, things that represent other things, ideas, events, nations, things in the future, things in the present. So it's in the vision, there are a number of images, a number of things John sees which represent other things. And you might think, oh, that's terrible then. How do we work out what they mean? You know, if you kind of go to an art gallery and look at a painting, you can stare at this painting and you can think, well, the artist was saying this, and someone else comes along and says, no, he was saying this. You know, that little girl there, sitting there, she's actually really unhappy. And I was like, no, she's really sad. She's really, whichever I said, the opposite of what I said. She's really happy, if I just said unhappy, or the opposite of that. So you kind of look at that, or, you know, he's looking at that, or no, he's looking at something else. You know what I mean? We can all interpret things differently, particularly if it's an obscure and an abstract kind of painting with, you know, loads of yellow and black, and we say, oh, it's hatred, or someone says, no, it's love, you know, in all its different colours or something. It's not like that with Revelation, though. It's not that hard. It's not that obscure. It's not like we all have to kind of stare at it for hours and hours and think, well, I think it means this, and someone else says, oh, I think it means this. It means that to me. We have a great resource, which is the rest of the Bible. Really helps. It really does in working out what's going on in the book of Revelation, and particularly as we get in to the stuff now. And the great benefit of the book is that it is vivid, spectacular. Helps us kind of envision things on a much bigger, broader scale. But we use some of the New Testament, but especially the Old Testament, to interpret the symbols that are there. Because pretty much it's always drawing on either a direct image or idea from the Old Testament, and sometimes a sort of composite, a set of things all put together. So we can use that as an interpretative key. So far, it's been fairly straightforward, hasn't it? We've looked at the vision of Jesus, looked at the messages, we've thought about God on the throne, we've thought about Jesus, the Lamb of God who was slain, being given all authority and being praised. So we're all pretty much okay with that, aren't we? We understood all that, pretty much. Now it gets a bit more difficult as we get into the visions, as they open out through the rest of the chapters. It gets a little bit easier again, perhaps, at the end. But as I say, don't be daunted by it. Just think Old Testament and some of the New Testament to help us interpret it. Because of time this evening, I'm not going to give you every single reference or connection. I might mention them. We're not going to look them all up because it would take some time. But if you want to have some more, then I can give you some more references. But actually, if you have a straightforward reference Bible, that's a Bible with cross-reference text down the middle, you pretty much can find them all from that. How do we then interpret the next few chapters from 6 onwards? How should we interpret these spectacular visions that are coming before our eyes, or before John's eyes and in our mind's eyes in his description? Some people would say that, yes, it's symbolic, but it's depicting literal, sequential, historical events, one after the other. Some people would say that. So they would say, yes, it's symbology. There's not literally a beast, or there's not literally, you know, 144,000 or something like that. But they would say it's depicting in sequence various things that will happen in history. Some people would say it's depicting things that have happened by our day, that were ahead perhaps when the book was written, but by now they've happened, like, for example, the flattening of Jerusalem by the Romans. So some people might say that. Or some people might say that, yeah, they're future still to us, mostly. But maybe some of them have happened, but most of them are still future to us. And various things are going to kind of happen and drop down in sequence. Of course, 2,000 years on, some of those theories have been debunked. Because over those 2,000 years, people have thought that various empires or movements or ideas could be kind of directly identified as something or someone in the book of Revelation, and that hasn't often worked out because as empires have fallen and haven't proved to be the end of the world and so on. So that's one idea, literal, sequential, if you've got that one. The other one, which is pretty much how we're going to take it, is these visions give us insight into the reality that will be across all time until the last day. We're in the last days, and until the last day of the last days, this will be the reality. So it takes us up to and including the end. And that's generally the approach we're taking. And I think as we work through these visions, what happens is the vision takes us through history, often to the end, and then sometimes kind of rewinds and starts again. We even see that this evening in these opening of the seals. They're not happening in sequence. They're things that are showing us what's happening right now and what will happen at the end. So that's the approach that we're going to take. This prophecy is explaining what's happening now in our world and where it's all heading. There are descriptions that perhaps seem to more directly match a world situation, sometimes more than others. There are sections that clearly point to the absolute end when Jesus returns. And there are other parts that just describe in general the world in which we live. So we might say that in this rest of the book of Revelation, there are many flypasts. I was trying to work out when I was making these notes what the plural of flypast is. Is it flypasts? It doesn't sound right. But anyway, there are many flypasts that they're given, looking over the whole of history to the end and then flying past again, looking at the whole of history to the end. That might help you when you're looking at it. So, now we're getting into it. Chapters 4 and 5, the throne room of God, the transcendent creator God, the Lamb, able, worthy to open the scroll, which, as Mark described last week, is the whole of history, the kind of plan for the whole of history. And the Lamb, Jesus, is worthy to unravel and to play out the whole of history. He's the sovereign Lord of history. He's in charge of history. And in the bit that we've just had read to us, the Lamb opens these seven seals. Imagine like a royal seal, a kind of wax seal. And after every seal is broken, it's a bit like a sort of pass the parcel where you unwrap a bit of it and there's a prize. So after every seal is opened, then something new happens, or something new happens before John's eyes as part of the vision. That's what we kind of work through. So I hope you're all right so far. I'll try and demonstrate how we're looking at it as we go through. So here we go. First of all, judgment, and then we have salvation, just to keep it simple. First of all, judgment, and we have the four horses, verses 1 through to 8 of chapter 6. The four horses of the apocalypse, as they're often called. I could have given you lots of pictures of them, but I think it would just be more of a distraction than anything else. As you look at these various coloured horses. The seals, in the first four seals, prompt these living creatures to call, and then a rider comes out. So there's the pattern, the end of verse 1. Come, one of the living creatures says, and then John looks, verse 2, and there before me was a white horse, and so on with the different colours. So verse 2, the first horse is white. It's a conqueror, going to war by force of arms. There's a crown representing victory. He will be victorious. That's the first horse. And all the horses, it would seem, represent spiritual forces in particular, or perhaps just the malevolent spirit in general in the world, going out, we might say, doing bad stuff. So the first horse is a conquering horse, or a conquering king on the horse. And it's the idea of one nation having great military power and force and overwhelming others. This has been the history of the world the last 2,000 years. Great empires. Maybe now we have business empires that wear the crowns and are victorious and have great power and authority. But we still have empires conquering others with their overwhelming military force. The history of the world has been one of devastation and overwhelming of the weak and invasions. So that's the first horse. That's what the first horse represents. Then the second horse is red, verse 4. And this horse, we're told, or the rider will be able to take away peace. It's the idea of civil unrest. Humans turning on each other. That happens at a kind of a low level. Brexit, Scottish independence, or not, depending on how you think about it. But it happens at a kind of a low level of discord, people disagreeing over things like that. Happens on a much bigger scale where people kill each other. Civil war going on in Syria at the moment, and to some degree in Iraq and in South Sudan. Civil wars in the past that have led to mass genocide, people killing each other. Think about the Balkan conflict or the Hutu conflict in Rwanda. Genocide, people killing each other with civil unrest. That's the second horse. Third horse, black horse. In verse 5. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, "Come," and before me was a black horse. And this horse represents scarcity, struggle. If you read different books, they're a bit unclear about precisely the measures that are being referred to in terms of wheat and so forth, but it would seem, whatever precisely, however precisely much wheat there is and how many people it would feed for how long and those sort of things, it's all about scarcity. Maybe the simplest idea is that there's enough for a man for a day, but for a day's wages he's got to feed his whole family, so there's basically not enough food. And actually the price is very high, I think a factor of 10 or 15 times higher than it would have been in John's day, the price. So scarcity of food. And then the fourth, green. It's like the idea when, you know, someone's had a sickie bug or something and you say, you know, what colour are they? Because the horse could be described as pale or as green. And we describe people who are ill in both those terms, don't we? You know, you look really green or you look really pale. You have the expression, you look like death warmed up. That's the kind of expression. And sadly, this is the kind of idea from this horse, this pale horse, the fourth horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind. Hades is the place of the death, of the dead. And what this rider will signal and herald, what this rider will achieve is death. It says they were given power over a quarter of the earth to kill by sword, famine and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. People will die by all kinds of different causes, some by the wars that are referred to earlier, some by the famine, by the scarcity that was referred to as well, some by plague, illness, some by wild beasts. There's a realism about these four horses. We're not supposed to look at them and think, this is really weird and kind of spectacular and sci-fi. We're supposed to look at them and think, this is our world. There's a realism about our world, which is full of these things. There are wars, there are conflicts, there are shortages, there is death. The consequence of us turning our back on God is that these judgments are sent out into the world. Life will be tough for many people, and this should not surprise us. And that's what these four horses are about. This is simply, but in a way devastatingly, what these horses are about. The plagues that are on the earth as a consequence of the fall and the rejection of Christ and the rejection of the rule of God. There are these evil forces unleashed in the world until the end. And there's a deep theological point here, which is that although these forces are destructive, God is still sovereign over them. God is sovereign even over evil. It's God who permits it. It's God who calls out these judgments through the living creatures. He is sovereign. He still sits on the throne. It's not as though you've got God the Father on the throne, you've got Jesus unraveling history, and there's a kind of, whoops, what's going on? This is all out of control. Yeah, it is chaotic. It looks chaotic, and to some degree it is chaotic. It is an unleashing of evil, but it's something that in his deep, mysterious purposes, God allows. There is still divine decree, divine permission. So that's the first thing, judgment in that sense. And in that context, there are questions for Christians. And we see that from verse 9. We're now onto the fifth seal, so we've done four, got three more to go. Onto the fifth seal in verse 9. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. What's that referring to? Christian martyrs. Not that they actually die to pay the penalty for sin or anything, but they're pictured as under the altar as though they're kind of worshipping, as though they've given their lives as a sacrifice. People who've been killed because they were Christians. And they're asking a very reasonable question. How long are you going to let this go on, God? How long is this going to be allowed to happen? All this evil that's unleashed. And how long before it actually continues to impact on us? Because these four horses are kind of have a general impact, but the evil that's unleashed also has an impact on Christians, as Christians are persecuted and as Christians are killed. And there's a cry from Christian martyrs to say, how long is this going to go on for? It's a real echo of many cries in the Old Testament, crying out, saying, God, your name is at stake. What kind of a God are you to let this happen? So you see that in Habakkuk 1, verse 2. You see that in Psalm 79. Have a read of verse 5 through to 10 there. How long before you vindicate your name, Lord? You're supposed to be just. You're supposed to be loving. You're supposed to be almighty. How long before you prove that? And how long before you vindicate our name because we have served you faithfully? It's not a bitter cry, but it's a cry for justice and for righteousness. How long, sovereign Lord? Notice they refer to God as sovereign Lord. They're not saying you're not in charge, but they're saying, how long is this going to go on for? And the response is that they're given a white robe, a sign of victory, a sign of purity, a sign of being blessed by God, a sign of their status. So they're assured of that. They're given a white robe, but they're told to wait a little longer. In fact, they're told to wait until the full number has been completed. There is a plan. God is allowing there to be more Christian martyrs, and there will be more before the end. But there will be an end. There will be martyrs killed under Nero, thrown to the lions, some crucified, some have their bodies set on fire. More killed under the emperors that followed, particularly Domitian. More after that. People killed just last century in Russia, in China. A few centuries ago, people killed for being Christians in this country. People being killed right now in South Korea. People being bombed in Egypt for being Christians. And this will happen until the end. I don't think we're to understand that there's a literal little group of martyrs who are actually saying this to God in this sense. It's a picture, it's an image. But it's a very powerful idea, and it's a question that we raise, isn't it? How long? We need to make sure that we're aligned with God in the way we ask those kind of questions. Sometimes we just say, how long before you stop me suffering in some way? And that's not really a good thing to ask God for. But a good question is, how long, Lord? I know you're sovereign and I know you're loving. How long? When will you vindicate your name? When will you come? Come, Lord Jesus. That's a good thing to cry. It's not a wrong thing. These martyrs are not condemned for what they're doing. They're told to wait. They're told to be patient. They're told there is a plan. They're told that they are secure. But it's a good prayer to keep praying. There is a plan. We cry for justice. We cry out for the final judgment. And sometimes we feel so comfortable in our world with our Christianity and the little degree of persecution we have that maybe we don't feel that quite so strongly. Kind of think, well, it's not too bad being a Christian, really. There's a bit of a bubbling up persecution happening, but it's not so bad. But in the history of the world, there's been loads of persecution of Christians. And maybe there will be more in even our day. And we need to feel that. We need to feel that it will cost us, but that God will in the end vindicate his name. And that's what happens next. Still thinking about judgment. The four horses, the question how long, and then judgment day itself, verses 12 through to 17. The sixth seal ushers in a terrible day of judgment. It's in a part the answer to the prayers. These prayers how long have been being prayed, and then finally judgment comes. And it's described in such cataclysmic terms, isn't it? Great earthquake, sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair, the whole moon turned blood red. What would you think if that was happening right now? You'd be absolutely frightened out of your wits. And I think that's the idea. And then verse 13, and the stars in the sky fell to the earth as a fig drops from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. Just you can imagine that picture. We know what it's like to shake a fruit tree, don't we? And you know, some of the fruit falls off. Can you imagine the stars kind of like dropping like that? These kind of asteroids, what do you call them? Comets, isn't it, when stars are flying through the air? You know, all that kind of happening. That's what happens before John's eyes. It's an idea that, again, is interpreted for us in the Old Testament. Isaiah 13, verse 10, or chapter 34, verse 4, and Hosea 2, and Matthew 24, Jesus speaking about the end, uses very similar language. Now, it could be talking about political upheaval, you know, like stars falling from the sky, as in emperors, you know, ending their throne, their reign, or something like that. It could be talking about that, but I don't think that's enough. It might be talking about that as things that happen on the way, but I think it's talking about the final judgment when Christ returns. That language there, verse 14, the heavens receded like a scroll being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. This is not just some political upheaval, however dramatic that might be. This is the end of the world as we know it. It really is. And you know what's most terrifying? Verse 16, they called to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Amongst those who are not the Christian martyrs and they're not the sealed that we'll think about in a moment, abject, complete fear, desperation. Isn't that such a powerful image? Thinking, I don't want to look at Jesus. I am so scared. I don't want to look at Jesus. Just get some rocks and fall on us somehow that I don't have to look at him. Don't have to see it. Because the Lamb slain is also the King of all the earth and the judge. And he's coming. And his wrath is coming now. And there'll be no place to hide. There's the cry for the rocks to fall and so forth, but it's not going to happen. And we need to remember texts like this now and then. Well, I suppose remember them all the time, but have them pointed out to us now and then to make us realise that judgment is coming. And it will be severe, it will be serious, it will be universal. There will be no hiding place. And it will be the unleashing of the wrath of God for the rebellion of men. It's a real event that's going to happen. Everyone will be caught up in that. And you need to read texts like this and think, this is a serious thing. This is a tragic thing that's going to happen. It's a harsh reality that the wrath of God will come, and we need to be ready for it. We need to be urgently telling our friends to flee from it. This is not a nice thing to talk about at dinner parties. This is not a therapeutic thing to talk about. You know, being a Christian makes me feel much better about myself or something like that. This is a, are you ready for the wrath of the Lamb? Now, of course, because people haven't got reference points and a context in our culture, you don't want to go door knocking in Hayward's Heath or the street evangelism we're going to do on the 1st of July and say, the first person we meet, are you ready for the wrath of the Lamb? That kind of American voice, you have to do it. They don't have a context to perhaps interpret that, but we've got to get there. You know, why bother to be a Christian just to make yourself feel a little bit better about yourself? It's not much, not enough, is it? You follow Christ because he's your saviour from the wrath. You follow him because he's amazing, because his love is stupendous, that he will deliver you from this. So we follow him. And of course we feel better about ourselves because we're absolutely rubbish and sinful, and yet he's loved us and given us a status that we'll see in just a moment. So yeah, we feel better about ourselves, but particularly we feel delighted, ecstatic, because we've been saved from the wrath that we justly deserve. And you need to feel that kind of fire in your belly, that wrath is coming, that the day of God's wrath is coming. You need to be ready. Your friends need to be ready. And we need to feel and know that. That's why the vision is here for us. So there is judgment. Judgment in the four horses, depicting, symbolizing various disasters and tragedies happening in the world. The cry, particularly of the martyrs, Christian martyrs, how long is this going to go on for? And then the answer, it's not going to go on forever. Judgment comes. But then we also see salvation. Verse 1 of chapter 7 begins after this, but that doesn't necessarily mean the events will happen after this. It just means that's the next thing he saw. Okay? So what we do now in chapter 7, we kind of take a different view. Because there's all this judgment stuff happening, and you think, well, where are the Christians? This thing is a bit of a disaster, because everyone's running away and wanting the rocks to fall on them and so forth, and here comes the wrath of the Lamb. So what's happened to the Christians? You'd be worried if you were reading this, if you just had chapter 6. You know, you got your scroll from John, he's just been delivered, and you got through chapter 6, and you go, I need the next episode! I need to binge watch Revelation, because I need to know what happens next. Well, it's not so much what happens next, but what uncovers the reality is here in chapter 7. There are those sealed, and there is this great multitude. Roughly speaking, I think we see the present state of the church and the future hope for the church. The present state and the future hope for the church. First of all, the present state. First verses of chapter 7. The judgment's being held back. The idea of the four winds and the four corners of the earth is a kind of idea of the whole earth. It's used quite a lot in the Bible. And judgment, it seems, is being held back for a while until a group of people are given the seal of the living God. And there's 144,000 who are sealed. That is the idea of a kind of a census for an army. Or the seal in the sense of ownership and authority. Already heard about that in earlier parts of Revelation. Various of the churches are kind of promised that ownership, having the name of God on them. It's there in Ezekiel 9, marking the righteous for protection from the judgment of God. You could say it's right there in the Passover. Remember when the blood is daubed over the doorpost? There's a kind of a mark, a seal that delivers them from the judgment. And I think that's the idea here. This is the church protected, those becoming Christians. Judgment is held back. We read about that in the rest of the Bible. Judgment being held back, so loads of you can become Christians, can be delivered. That's why God hasn't brought the final day. He is patient, not wishing anyone to perish. And while history plays out in these devastating ways, the final judgment is withheld. So there can be many who are given the seal, the mark. As we'll see in a moment, it's those who've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. Later on, those whose names in the book of life, the book of the Lamb, the Lamb's book of life. So it's Christians. Why 144,000? I think it's just a number. 12 times 12 times 1,000. Maybe thinking about the 12 disciples representing Israel. Maybe thinking, I'm sorry, 12 tribes of Israel. Maybe thinking about the 12 disciples representing the church. Multiply that by 1,000. 1,000 is often used in the Bible to kind of just describe a big number. So you end up with a big number. If you're like super astute, and I don't think I would have been if I just kind of read it without any other commentaries, is you'll notice that the 12 tribes are not listed perfectly there. Dan is missing and replaced by Manasseh. Maybe a bit like the fact that Judas wouldn't be perhaps in the list of the 12 disciples. So it's not supposed to be taken literally in that sense. It's just a representative number. All the believers in the Old Testament, all the believers since the New Testament. They're owned, they're protected, they have the seal of God. They're servants of God. And then John sees something else. He sees the future hope. You might say that the sealed here represent those who are becoming Christians and who are marked out. You could say it represents all of them because it's got the Old Testament part, or you could say it represents those who are just currently Christians now on the earth. It doesn't matter much because it all comes to fruition in this second vision. After this, I looked, verse 9, and there's this great multitude that no one could count. It's the group of the glorified saints, people who are Christians, in heaven. You could say it's the present experience of Christians in heaven. You could say that. But I think it's more looking towards the end because it's looking at, in a sense of fulfillment of a great multitude from every nation, tribe, people and language standing before the throne and worshipping. That's what Abraham was promised, wasn't it? Be blessing to all the nations. That's what happens. It's blessing to all the nations. They're shouting, they're singing, they're waving palm branches. That's the idea of the Feast of Tabernacles that was celebrated in the Old Testament. Praising God for his deliverance. And so they're praising God. Don't know whether we'll be or they are, literally, waving something. But it's just the idea in the cultural and biblical terms that they understood, the idea of praising God. There's a question, who are these? And it's asked in an answer. Verse 13, then one of the elders asked me, it's one of those questions that he can't answer, these in white robes, who are they and where did they come from? I answered, sir, you know. And he said, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And therefore they're serving God in a perfect world. They are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. This is an echo of what will come later, isn't it? But it's giving them again in categories that they understood. What's a perfect world for you? It's this. What would be a wonderful experience for you, serving God, completely sheltered, no hunger, no thirst, no sun beating down, not not thinking of sun beating down like, you know, nice spring sunshine like we've enjoyed today. It's not about that. It's about the hot, burning, damaging sun in the Middle East. So none of that that will damage or burn or spoil or age. And they'll have this perfect shepherd, Jesus, who will lead them and lead them to provision, to springs of living water. Just what he promised, springs of living water. Remember, he's speaking to the woman at the well, and he promises a wellspring of life. Holy Spirit will come and will give you new life, and it will be a life that lasts forever, and you will never thirst again. She says, give me this water. And you're supposed to read this and say, yeah, give me this water. I want to be there. It's the saints. And in the context of judgment and some degree of misery and questioning and the harsh reality that judgment is coming, judgment is already happening and final judgment is coming, in that context, it's just brilliant that as part of these seven seals, we see here's the church, secure right now, sealed. And here's the church, praising God, into the future, completely secure. And it should both terrify us, but at the same time give us stupendous hope and joy. Just for completeness, we have the seventh seal, chapter 8, verse 1. And there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. But I think it's too important to land precisely what that means. Maybe it's the silence of all the activity of judgment being over. Maybe it's just a pause in the vision in order for the next round of visions, if you like, to start off. Sometimes when there's been lots of noise in prophecies, silence is kind of, you know, there are no more answers, everything's been answered. So it might be symbolizing that, the peace and the answer and the quietness, in a sense, of heaven. But here's what we learned. We experience now suffering and the fallout of the judgment of God. We experience a lack of complete and final justice, but there will be final justice. But our status right now, your status right now, if you're a Christian, is one who has been sealed, who's been marked out to say you will not die the second death. You will not fall foul of the wrath of the Lamb. And what's the criteria? How do you get to be in this status? Well, it's put there for us in verse 14. These are they who come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. The Lamb is a really powerful image in the book of Revelation. I think it's 28 times that it's used. It's the idea of a sacrifice, of a perfect sacrifice. And being washed in the blood of the Lamb, which is a funny idea, really, isn't it? Because you think about blood as being red, and that's hardly going to make your clothes whiter, is it? But it's a kind of funny image, but it's to make the point that by the sacrifice of Jesus, his blood, the dirtiness of your sin and your rebellion is washed away, and you're able to enter into that perfect world before the throne of God to seal him. And this is not really a kind of do text. This is not, you know, this is true, so do this. But it's part of the big do of Revelation, which is, what do? You trust God and you keep going, serving him faithfully, because it's all going somewhere. That's our encouragement this evening. You trust God, you keep going, because history is leading somewhere, both to judgment, but also to final salvation and perfection. So with joy, even in troubles, and with realism about troubles, we keep going. We don't compromise. We don't give up on the gospel because it's the only hope for people. We don't get surprised when we're persecuted. We urgently tell people, flee from the wrath of the Lamb, flee to the arms of the Saviour, be washed in the blood of the Lamb, and then you'll be ready for this eternal world.